Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hold everything. Stop the presses or whatever it is that we say in radio. The Federal Reserve, well, it did nothing on interest rates today. Oh, and Apple, by the way, basically has a license to print money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of KQED in San Francisco, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 28th of January today. It has been going on 6 years now since the recession ended, and I feel completely secure in saying the following sentence aloud to all y'all. In all of that time, never has there been a less anticipated meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, because interest rates are staying right where they are. Chair Janet Yellen and her colleagues said again after their meeting and their statement today that they will be, quote, patient on tightening monetary policy. June is about the earliest we ought to look for anything. That as the economy and the labor market, again, using the Fed's words, are solid and strong. Not much more than a passing nod at the weakening global economy. By the by, next meeting is scheduled for the 17th and 18th of March. So go ahead, mark your calendars. As we told you yesterday, Apple had a very good quarter last quarter. All right, it was a great quarter. All right, it was an historic, crazy, insane quarter. They made, as in profited, $18 billion. Much of it thanks to the iPhone. Turns out people really do want a bigger screen, especially in China, where iPhone sales doubled year over year. But just because it can't all be sunshine and light, is it possible that Apple is putting too many eggs in the iPhone basket? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look.
Apple sold more than 74 million iPhones in 3 months.
This volume is hard to comprehend.
Yes, it is, Tim Cook, Apple CEO. So let him break that down for you.
On average, we sold over 34,000 iPhones every hour, 24 hours a day, every day of the quarter.
That's a lot of phones. So, high fives all around?
The iPhone 6 was a great success, but how long can it last, and what is going to be the follow-up?
Michael Abuhofsky isn't trying to be a Debbie Downer. He's an Apple shareholder and the portfolio manager of Concert Wealth Management.
Even though the Mac sales are doing well, we have a situation where 70% of the revenues of a very large company are driven by single product line.
And that concerns him long term. Companies that generate most of their sales from one product can be risky, says J.P. Eggers. He's a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. But Eggers says Apple's not some cupcake shop built on a fad. He thinks Apple's specialization is actually a strength.
More focused firms tend to be more innovative. They're able to better understand the consumers. They're able to invest in a narrower range of technologies and be able to produce better and higher quality products by being more focused.
The iPod, the iPad, the iPhone. Ramon Lamas with the market research firm IDC thinks Apple will come up with the new hot products of tomorrow just as they have in the past.
If there's one thing that you learn about Apple over the years, don't bet against them.
Or at the very least, wait and see how the Apple Watch does in the spring. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Yeah, I think we'll be watching that watch as it happens. We are about to start learning what low oil prices mean for big oil companies. Shell reports quarterly profits tomorrow, by which I mean they report for the first time since it became clear that oil prices were headed all the way over the cliff and likely to stay there for a good long while. The other oil majors, as they're called, ExxonMobil, BP, and Chevron, to name just a couple, are going to follow in the next couple of days. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
It's not that big oil companies love low prices, but there's a part of them that doesn't mind. A company like Shell isn't just a producer selling crude oil. It's also a refiner buying crude oil and selling gasoline. Barbara Shook is Houston Bureau Chief for Energy Intelligence.
Gasoline prices have come down, but not at quite the same rate as crude oil prices, which means its refining company is making more money.
The big guys have another advantage. Long-term planning. Developing big projects like, say, a drilling rig in the Arctic takes years. James Sweeney is a professor at Stanford who studies energy policy.
They're always looking at least 10, 20 years down the road. So they're not a quarter-to-quarter type of company.
And companies that make long-term plans know that oil prices tend to go up and down over time.
If they didn't notice that, they'd have to be pretty blind. Oil companies understand this reality.
At least the biggest ones. Lots of smaller producers jumped into the fracking boom with both feet. They financed their drilling with borrowed money, figuring to pay it back, selling oil at $100 a barrel. David Bellman runs All Energy Consulting.
Yes, there definitely are companies that are in big trouble, but they're not the big name companies.
Meanwhile, if oil prices stay low, some of the big companies' advantages will fade a bit. Those high margins for refining will go down over time.
You just can't, you know, keep prices high on a sustained period because competition erodes it.
The quarterly reports may tell us whether that's started yet. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the bottom dropped out as the closing bell approached. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The president, as you may have heard, has done a 180 on his plan to tax college savings accounts known as 529s. Seems pretty much everybody rallied around the idea that even if you are comfortable, paying for college is a bear and any help is welcome help. Families that are eligible for more aid, though, face another problem, the daunting process of applying for it. The dreaded federal financial aid form comes out on January the 1st every year and is due in many states by early March. But every year, at least a million high school seniors don't even bother to apply for that aid, leaving millions of dollars on the table. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports on efforts to simplify the form, known simply as the FAFSA.
There's a huge chart posted on the wall outside Terry Williams' office. She's a college access specialist at Vivian T. Thomas Medical Arts Academy, a high school in Baltimore. The chart lists the names of all 90 seniors and where they are in the college application process.
Have they gone on any college tours? How many applications have they done? Have they completed their FAFSA?
The FAFSA, that's the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. The federal government, states, and colleges all use it to figure out who gets aid and how much. Most of Williams' students don't have a shot at affording college without help. So she sends out letters, text messages, even intercepts students on their way to the bathroom to make sure they fill out the form on time.
I don't care where they are. I'm going to stop you so we can get it taken care of.
Taking care of it means answering up to 108 questions. Have you had a drug conviction? How much do your parents make? Is either a dislocated worker? For lots of students, just tracking down some of that information can be a challenge.
They just feel like this is too much. I can't do it.
The move is on to make things easier. The Obama administration has proposed eliminating 27 questions. A bipartisan bill in Congress would replace the FAFSA with a postcard asking just two questions, household size and income. Carrie Warwick with the National College Access Network says for most families, those two questions tell the government everything it needs to know.
Most of those additional questions are really targeted at families with much more complicated financial situations.
Like wealthier families with assets and investments. The FAFSA does have some defenders. Justin Drager is president of the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. He says the vast majority of students now fill it out online, and so-called skip logic technology lets them bypass questions that don't apply.
The average student today can complete the entire FAFSA start to finish in 20 minutes.
That doesn't count the time it may take to dig up and sort through the right tax files and bank records. Drager is all for getting rid of questions that don't have anything to do with a student's financial need, like the one about drug convictions. But he says when colleges give out their own grants and scholarships, they rank students by their relative need, and they need a lot of details to do that fairly.
If we make the application too simple, that ultimately means that more colleges will introduce their own applications, and the net result for students is nothing's changed.
There is one change pretty much everyone agrees on. Right now, the FAFSA asks for data from the most recent tax year. If you're applying for aid right now, that would be 2014. But most of us haven't filed our taxes yet. Lauren Asher is president of the Institute for College Access and Success. She says if families could use their returns from 1 year earlier, they could import their tax info directly from the IRS and apply for aid a lot sooner.
If you can file the FAFSA more easily and earlier, you're much more likely to benefit from all the available aid that can help you pay for college and get to graduation.
In many states, grant money is handed out on a first-come, first-served basis until it's gone. A recent report from Edvisors says students who file their FAFSA in the first 3 months of the year get more than twice as much grant aid on average as those who wait longer. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The latest note in the near constant drumbeat of health data swirling around out there comes in the form of an estimate that more than 70% of hospitals are going to pay fines this year. That's fines for everything ranging from having too many hospital-acquired infections to too many patient readmissions to too high a mortality rate. It is data that consumers often have trouble making sense of or, in fact, even getting their hands on, which means for businesses, it can be an opportunity. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the Health Desk at WHYY.
When we want to find a doctor or a hospital, about 75 to 80% of us pretty much do the same exact thing.
As we've always done, to ask people that we know.
That's right. Friends and family are our primary sources, says Wendy Lynch, a fellow with the Alterum Institute. Lynch has conducted patient surveys and focus groups since 2011, and most patients, she says, have the same priority.
They choose a safer hospital 95% of the time.
That's what makes these hospital penalties tricky. If the hospital down the block just got docked $1 million, does that mean it's dangerous?
I think it would be really difficult to say that that is the primary litmus test for whether or not that is a hospital that should be sought out or avoided.
Paul Matsui of the consultant group, the Advisory Board, knows it's easy to have a knee-jerk reaction, but he says Medicare assesses lots of quality measures. Some places get dinged for how much patient care costs. Others are penalized if they get low patient satisfaction scores. Then there's the super scary infection rates. The consumer group Leapfrog is in the business of rating hospitals. CEO Leah Binder says more important than the fine, a patient must consider their actual needs.
If you are seeking, for example, hip replacement surgery, that's very different than if you need care for heart failure.
We're seeing the entire healthcare industry pivot towards looking at health outcomes. Even this week, HHS announced a plan to tie Medicare payments to patient health. That means more information for healthcare shoppers to consume. And while most of us go to people we know for recommendations, surveys show a growing hunger for independent sources to help us. That's why everybody and their brother is getting into the healthcare ratings game, says Harvard's Dr. Ashish Jha. But he warns, buyers beware.
By one estimate, 1,600 American hospitals are on a list of America's top 100 hospitals. So it's a little bit of a mess.
One person's mess is another person's opportunity. Every expert I spoke with for this story agrees. No one's mastered the science and art of healthcare ratings yet. Whoever does stands to make a boatload and bring a little light to people making serious choices. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
everybody in town, it seemed, was connected to that factory.
And then the factory left town. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 195 points today, 1.1%, closed at 17,191. The NASDAQ off 43 points, 0.9%, 4637. The S&P 500 dropped 27 points, that is 1.3%, ended things at a neatly symmetrical 2002. Apple sweetened 5.2%. We told you why up at the top of the broadcast. Boeing flew up 5.4% today. The airplane maker saw profits leap 19% on the fourth quarter on strong demand for commercial jet airliners. Tupperware brand snapped up 11.6% today. Video game maker Electronic Arts played up almost 13%. Computer chip maker Freescale Semiconductor buzzed up 18.25% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors issues its December Pending Home Sales Index. Earnings season continues with reports from Hershey, Amazon, and Google. And its nickname is the Sunflower State. On January 29, 1861, Kansas became the 34th state to join the Union. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It may somehow have escaped you, but 30 years ago today, there was a big change in large-scale philanthropy. Michael Jackson and Diana Ross, Cyndi Lauper, Willie Nelson, Paul Simon and Kenny Rogers, Lionel Richie and Dionne Warwick. Believe me when I tell you the list goes on. All of them gathered at the A&M Recording Studios in Hollywood to record the charity single We Are the World. Whatever you think about the merits of that song, and opinions do differ, it helped change the way we think about celebrities and causes and disasters. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
It starts with Lionel Richie, who wrote the song with Michael Jackson. Jackson was at the pinnacle of his career in 1985 and drove the project along with producer Quincy Jones and singer Harry Belafonte.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call.
And then over the next 7 minutes, a multicultural, multi-music genre who's who of stars take their solos and choruses. The song was phenomenally successful, one of the top-selling singles ever, raising more than $60 million for African Aid. It spurred other charity singles and concerts, Live Aid, Farm Aid, Live 8, Live Earth, the list goes on. But it wasn't the first, says Jonathan Taplin at the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab. The Concert for Bangladesh, which he produced in 1971, set the mold. We Are the World nailed it.
We Are the World was a hit single in a days when people still had to pay for music.
Taplin says it would be a hard act to repeat.
The irony is, of course, if you put out a single to try and raise money, even an online download, most of the people would probably steal it.
We Are the World's financial success also helped popularize cause-related marketing, says Leslie Lenkowski at the Indiana University Philanthropy Program. The idea is everybody wins, except...
It is controversial. People feel that charitable giving should be more altruistic, that you shouldn't get something when you give something.
Lenkowski says there are benefits, though. The artists get publicity, the donor consumers get music, and the aid recipients get aid, at least whatever profits are left after the music production is done. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Ten years ago, back before he was really anybody, Barack Obama gave a speech. The speech, you could say, the 2004 Democratic National Convention. The There's Not a Red America and a Blue America, There's a United States of America speech. He talked about a lot of things in that speech, the then senator did, including globalization.
And fellow Americans, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, I say to you tonight, we have more work to do. More work to do for the workers I met in Galesburg, Illinois, who are losing their union jobs at the Maytag plant that's moving to Mexico, and now are having to compete with their own children for jobs that pay $7 an hour.
10 years on from that speech, almost 11 now, Galesburg, Illinois is the subject of a new book about globalization, about not the big macroeconomic impacts, but about people and what happens when the big factory in town shuts down and leaves for Mexico. The book is called Boom, Bust, Exodus by Chad Broughton. Chad, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the invitation, Kai.
You went to Galesburg for the first time a couple of years before that speech by Obama, 2001. What was it like then, while this Maytag plant was still up and running?
There was a lot of anxiety in town, I'd say. There's a new cost-cutting CEO at the helm of Maytag. They had opened up two factories in Reynosa, Mexico, and so you know, there are some rumors swirling around that the factory might be in jeopardy. And so, you know, I played basketball with a manager at the Maytag factory. And I, you know, had conversations here and there with people who were connected to Maytag. Everybody in town, it seemed, was connected to that factory.
This is a very person-driven economic story on both sides of the border, right? Down in Reynosa, Mexico, and also in Galesburg. And you start with a guy by the name of Mike Patrick, who starts at the plant which then wasn't Maytag, it was somebody else. But he starts there in 1959 doing this job that seems anachronistic, putting insulation inside these refrigerators. Describe it for me for a minute.
Right. It was like cotton candy, basically, and he stuffed it into the metal shell of the cabinet of the refrigerator. And he did that all day, basically. And later on, they would get the technology to sort of just inject it in. And that technology actually was developed in Galesburg. But they were very physical jobs. They're 1959, 1960s, and they're tough jobs. He would go home at the end of the day and take a cold bath so the prickly stuff, the insulation, would come out of his skin so he'd get ready for the next day.
And then one day, Mike Patrick gets a phone call, and I want to play his reaction.
One evening, I got a call from Maytag, the head human relations guy from Maytag Corporation, saying that he'd like to meet with myself and the union committee, that they were going to put out an announcement that they were going to close the plant and move to Mexico.
Just like that. Done.
Yeah, that was the big announcement in actually 2002.
Yeah.
It really stunned the town. And, you know, they felt like this was a year after 9/11. And so a lot of the protests around this, the rallies at Labor Day, the rallies at the shareholders meeting that I describe in the book, you know, they were very nationalistic, very patriotic. And they felt that this was a profoundly unpatriotic thing to do by the company, by this very American company, this quintessentially American company, Maytag.
And they go and they open up a plant in Reynosa, Mexico, down south of the border. Mm-hmm. The Mexican counterpart to Mike Patrick, in a way, I suppose, is this woman named Laura Flora. She's in Reynosa. She works at the Maytag plant there. What happens to her life? What is her story?
Yeah, well, she felt like there weren't opportunities for her kids in the rural areas of Veracruz, so she came north. She brought them north. But when she got to the border, she was fearful of the circumstances there around the crossing, and so she decided to stick it out in Reynosa for the time being, and she ended up kind of stuck there. And so she had to do what she had to do, which was work in these abundant, low-skill jobs mm-hmm. in the maquiladoras, and she did that at Maytag for about 3.5 years until Whirlpool bought Maytag and closed that factory and moved it further south.
Right, and then there's the irony. Whirlpool buys Maytag, and then this factory mm-hmm. that Maytag had moved all its stuff to out of Galesburg closes itself.
Right. Right. It lasted, I think, 3.5 years in Reynosa, and then they moved it, Whirlpool did, to Ramos Arizpe, just north of Saltillo, Mexico. Mm. And there today, that's where Whirlpool makes its side-by-side refrigerators. About 3,200 workers produce about 2,500 refrigerators per day in that assembly plant.
I want to end actually with the beginning, with the prologue of this book. The scene is you driving into town on what, Illinois Route 41 through the corn and the soybeans. And then you get into town and you come upon the remnants, I guess, of this factory. And I want you to read a little bit that starts behind the welcome sign.
Behind the welcome sign is a vacant parking lot scattered with concrete blockades and rubble. And behind the parking lot rises a massive white-gray box of a building. A stylish cobalt blue line wraps around its roof like a gigantic ribbon around a gift box. Several years ago, you could have made out Maytag, but the outlines of the letters have faded. Now there's only a pockmarked facade with spots of flaking paint, discolored exterior panels, and two big available signs, one with an 1-800 number and another advertising what remains of this empty giant, plus or minus 707,624 square feet.
I love that, plus or minus 707,624. what's it like to walk through that empty plant today? As I'm sure you have done on your visits to Galesburg.
Yeah, I did it a few weeks ago, actually. It's so big still, even though only one-third of it still stands. You know, when it was still entirely there, it took a mile to walk from one end to the other, and now it still feels very big and empty. You know, I walked through with Mike Patrick, who had worked there for, I think, 4 decades, And he had a quite emotional experience walking through it again. It just, you know, it's empty and feels hollow now.
It's a book called Boom, Bust, Exodus by Chad Broughton. Chad, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
We've got an excerpt of Chad Broughton's book on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which Taylor Swift becomes the very model of a shrewd entrepreneur. Ms. Swift has gotten trademarks for a whole mess of lyrics from her most recent zillion-selling album, 1989, including Party Like It's 1989, This Sick Beat, and Nice to Meet You, Where You Been? Also, more. She owns them for everything from public appearances and clothing to ornaments and downloadable and non-downloadable games. As the website Vox points out, singers are making an increasing slice of their income, not from actually singing, but from stuff like that. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow off 195 points, the NASDAQ down 43 points, the S&P 500 lost itself 27 points. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. Thanks today to our friends here at KQED. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.